Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go. Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hi, friends, and welcome back to the Saturday Frights podcast. We have reached the end of our celebration of getting to our 50th episode, discussing each segment of George A. Romero and Stephen King's tribute to those 1950s horror comics with their anthology film, Creepshow.
We should warn you up front that our broadcast today might really bug you, dear listeners.
Today we'll be talking about the fifth and final segment of Creepshow, They're Creeping Up On You. Of course, we will also be talking about what could be considered to be the sort of sixth segment to the movie. You'll remember on the Father's Day podcast, the film opens with a family disturbance.
Yes. I do wonder what little Billy has been up to.
You'll just have to wait until the end of our synopsis to discuss it. Projectionist, while you didn't care for the lonesome death of Jordy Verrill, this is the segment that I found to be my least favorite.
How can that be, Sage?
I just didn't care for it. As I've said on the podcast before, there is no story in the movie that is bad. This one, though, doesn't capture my interest.
They're Creeping Up On You is absolutely the segment that feels most like an EC comic. More Vault of Horror than Tales from the Crypt, in my personal opinion. You have a miserly businessman who gets his just rewards for his lack of humanity.
Again, I'm not saying it's a bad segment, just that it doesn't capture my attention as much as the others. It could be how short it is. I mean, you pretty much just summed up the entire segment right there. Anyway, like Father's Day and Something to Tide You Over, They're Creeping Up On You is not an adaptation of a Stephen King story. In fact, this almost wasn't the segment to round out Creepshow. Due to the possible problems with working with the extras, King wrote a backup story just in case.
Oh, yes. Stevie mentioned this to me yesterday in the cafeteria, Victor. Due to the original screenplay that author Stephen King drafted, it called for a rather lush penthouse apartment as the setting for this segment. If filming this had turned out to be too difficult to pull off with the hissing roaches, they would have substituted it with the raft, which in fact was included in Creepshow 2.
I'm afraid our new intern is quite wrong, projectionist. Although it was a story that was used in the 1987 sequel, it was The Hitchhiker. Romero and King were able to film this segment when they decided that that lush penthouse that you talked about wasn't really needed, and it would fit the character more to have instead a sterile apartment.
The Hitchhiker! That is what I said!
What? You just said the substitute story was the raft!
No, I didn't.
Yes! Yes, you did!
Afraid not!
Projectionist, you just said Stevie told you—
No, Stevie is just a nincompoop. You are just wasting valuable time, Victor. You should get to the synopsis already.
Oh, working with you makes my head hurt so much. By the way, my friend, you still haven't opened that package that Stevie brought here to the control booth.
It's probably my latest shipment of trailers from the Philip Carey Library. I'll open it later.
They're Creeping Up On You, like all of the segments in Creepshow, starts off on a comic book illustration that slowly transitions to live action. We meet our main protagonist, Upson Pratt, played by the legendary E.G. Marshall, as he is dispatching with a great sense of satisfaction a cockroach on the floor of that supposedly sterile apartment.
Upson Pratt is evidently a germaphobe, judging from his medical facial mask, bathrobe, white rubber gloves, and slippers. He has a little Howard Hughes in him, I suppose.
Pratt is definitely a shut-in who is quite happy to live in his state-of-the-art suite. He can control every part of his living area through his 1970s-looking computer systems. I do believe his main computer is actually a disguised Apple IIe. Thanks to his high-tech systems, Upson can monitor everything from the stock market to the current air quality outside the very building his apartment is located in.
A building that Upson Pratt owns, we might add.
That he does. There is nothing comfortable about the apartment. Like I mentioned just a second ago, it's incredibly sterile, which makes sense with Pratt's phobia, as the projectionist mentioned, and also helps to give us insight to his character. He is a cold man, giving little thoughts to feelings or emotions, besides anger, that is, and is most certainly a control freak.
He does have one small concession to comfort Victor. That rather beautiful Wurlitzer jukebox, playing a version of the Charleston, I believe.
True. Pratt is absolutely livid after killing the cockroach, and as he goes about washing his hands, which, remember, he was wearing disposable gloves, so that should clue you into how bad his germophobia is. By the way, the ashtray from Father's Day is seen in this scene. Since Pratt's character doesn't smoke, of course, it is being used as a soap dish. Upson is angry, of course, because as we are often told in this segment, he pays quite a sum of money to be sure his apartment is germ-proof. When the phone rings in the other room, Pratt is almost gleeful as he swears that heads will roll over the appearance of the cockroach. The approaching storm outside his building seems to match his mood.
Upson Pratt believes it's the building superintendent. However, it is one of his executives with news on a hostile takeover of a company known as Pacific Aerodyne. And more importantly, it concerns one Mr. Norman Kastenmeier.
George, the executive who is calling, informs him that they have succeeded in the takeover of Norman's company. Pratt isn't happy about it. It seems to be beneath him, actually. Upson is obviously a shrewd man, as he treats it like there was no other possible outcome. He's more interested in the appearance of yet another cockroach. Or is it?
I wondered if you noticed that, Sage. George A. Romero makes sure that the viewer sees the dead cockroach next to the can of spray in earlier scenes. And during the talk with the executive, we can see it is gone.
Exactly. George, however, is trying to tell his boss a bit of shocking news that he believes is most important. Due to Norman not being able to prevent the hostile takeover, the poor man took his own life. Pratt is stunned at this news. For a second, we the viewers wonder if we hadn't possibly judged the man too harshly. Then, almost immediately, Upson begins to smile joyously as he happily tells George that at least they won't have to offer the man a seat on the board now.
Upson Pratt keeps his eye on the prize constantly, eh?
Judging by how he has his systems track his substantial net worth, I think you're right. The callous remark from his boss shocks George a little, but Pratt is quick to end his conversation with the man. He has to deal with that cockroach, which, to his horror, has managed to creep up on him and climb upon his gloved hand. Very slowly, he dumps it into a disposal, coating the cockroach with the spray until the powerful vacuum sucks it, presumably to an incinerator. The phone rings again, and Upson, assuming it's at last the vacationing superintendent of his building calling him back, receives a call he hadn't quite expected.
Indeed. Dear listeners, even I was appalled at how ruthless Upson Pratt is with this particular caller.
Reynolds, White, talk to me.
I just called to tell you what a monster you are, Mr. Pratt, and how I will rejoice when you're finally dead.
Lots of people are going to rejoice when I'm dead. Who are you?
Lenore Kastenmeier. I'm the wife of the man you murdered this afternoon.
Mrs. Kastenmeier, how are you?
I hope they keep hell hot for you. I hope they do. It wasn't enough for you to drive him to his knees, was it? No, you had to kill him as well. He came home. And his eyes were so dead. I asked him what was wrong. What could be so bad to make his eyes look that way? And the only word he could say was your name. 10 minutes later, I heard the shot.
Yes. George Genron told me old Norman went out with a bang.
How many men have you destroyed? How many men have you killed, you monster?
Only the stupid ones. Only the ones who handed me a knife and then stretched out their throats. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got this bug problem, so we'll have to defer your charming conversation for another time.
I hope you die.
By the way,
I hope you get cancer in the worst place.
Mrs. Katzenmeier.
Leprosy. Screaming hell for
it. Mrs. Katzenjammer, would you mind telling me who gave you my private number? I'd like to fire him.
It was in my husband's address book. Oh.
Well, I can't fire him, can I?
After listening to that clip, I think it's pretty clear to you listeners that Pratt isn't a very nice guy. That's okay, I suppose, as the forces of the supernatural are just about ready to give him a deadly wake-up call. After finally getting the superintendent on the phone, Pratt bullies the man with a threat of ending his employment if he doesn't get an attendant and an exterminator to take care of the roach issue within 30 minutes. Now bear in mind, this is late in the evening, almost midnight. But Pratt gets his wish, and allows us to see that besides being a bully and being heartless, to top it off, he's also quite racist. While he waits for the exterminators to arrive, Pratt makes himself a quick dinner, talking to himself, explaining that he grew up in Hell's Kitchen, and that taught him how to deal with bugs.
At which point, he reveals that everyone he has come in contact with, in his mind, are nothing but bugs, and that you have to keep an eye on them, as they will creep up on you.
Things are indeed creeping up on Pratt. He looks down at his food to see something odd. Rushing into his kitchen, he looks in the food processor, and you guessed it. There seems to be a very, very large cockroach within his meal. Tipping over an open box of cereal, we see roaches dash out and across the kitchen counter and floor. Pratt cries out in alarm and tries to smash them, before he rushes back to his control center. Frantically trying to get the police, he is horrified as more and more cockroaches are appearing. Climbing out of the computers, they are even crawling out of the jukebox, all heading to Upson.
Which is a very bad time for a brownout to hit the city, thanks to the thunderstorms.
As lightning flashes illuminate the apartment, we can see the cockroaches are climbing up Pratt now. He shrieks as he knocks them off his clothing, and then takes shelter in his hermetically sealed bedroom, where he turns and stares out through the plastic walls and vows that they will all pay in the morning. When the exterminators arrive, he will see them all get what they deserve. What all bugs deserve. The phone rings next to his bed, and when he presses the speakerphone, it's Mrs. Katzenmeier, who growls. She hopes that the evil man dies, saying it over and over and over again.
Which is the moment when Upson Pratt notices that his bed seems to be twitching.
Pratt slowly pulls back the sheet on his bed, and to his absolute fear is confronted by a seething mass of cockroaches, who quickly swarm him. Mrs. Katzenmeier on the phone is shrieking for his demise, as Upson realizes he is trapped in the room with the very thing he loathes and fears the most.
It is all just too much for Upson Pratt, who clutches at his chest as he is struck down by a heart attack.
We jump to the next morning, and everything in the apartment is spotless. I mean, there is no sign whatsoever of there ever having been cockroaches in there. Projectionist, did you feel that possibly this was all in Pratt's head? Perhaps all those years of being such a wretch, caring for no one but himself, just finally made him snap, and he just imagined the entire thing.
A very good theory, Victor. Especially with the state of Upson Pratt's suite. However, as we viewers see in his bedroom, looking upon the still form of the man, there is a trickle of blood that begins to leak down his temple. And then, before our very eyes, thousands upon thousands of roaches begin to emerge from Upson Pratt's mouth. They crawl bloodily out of his chest, and literally, the last thing we see is his body consumed by the hungry cockroaches, almost filling the entire bedroom.
And while this segment may be short, that is the stunning finale for They're Creeping Up on You.
Sage, were you aware of who the filmmakers originally wanted to play for the part of Upson Pratt?
I don't. Who was it?
Only the exorcist, Max von Sydow.
You know, I have a very hard time picturing anyone other than E.G. Marshall playing this part. He truly is that good. Even at that horrible moment when he's laughing at Mrs. Kastenmeier, his performance still makes you laugh rather guiltily. But Max von Sydow? That would have been something to see for sure. I do know that the filmmakers had to be absolutely perfect on their record-keeping in regards to the hissing roaches used in the film, as they were imported from Guatemala. A crew member was tasked with counting each one before filming, and accounting for any that perished during the shoot. Romero also faked the Legion of Cockroaches by adding a large supply of raisins.
I don't know which disgusts me more, the cockroaches or the raisins. After the end of their creeping up on you, we find ourselves back outside of little Billy's home. It is early morning now, and two garbage men take great interest in the young boy's thrown-away issue of Creepshow.
One of those garbage men happens to be special makeup effects guru Tom Savini. He and his co-worker get excited by the offers that one could mail away for from the comic book. The one they want most, the voodoo doll, has already been sent away for, however. Inside Billy's house, his father, Stan, who, if you haven't heard the Father's Day episode, is played by Tom Atkins, is having a bad morning. Grumpily, he yells for his son to come downstairs for breakfast. His wife gently scolds him, and Stan admits he didn't get much sleep the night before. He was kept up all night due to unexplained pains.
Perhaps it's his guilty conscience on how he treated Billy the previous night.
Stan's wife is puzzled when, as she's ironing one of her husband's shirts, she finds that a piece of it has been cut off. At that moment, Stan cries out in pain, standing up from the kitchen table, clutching his throat with both hands. The scene switches to Billy upstairs in his bedroom. He has used the piece of his father's shirt to wrap a voodoo doll and is gleefully jabbing it with long needles, whispering that this will teach him to throw away his comic books. The ashtray from Father's Day makes an appearance on Billy's desk, holding those sharp metal instruments that the young boy plans on using on the voodoo doll. And that, friends, is 1982's Creepshow. Projectionist, before we discuss the notable cast, did you bring any drive-in ads for the listeners?
I did. In fact, friend to the Saturday Frights broadcast, Travis Faligant, was the very soul who gave us the idea of what to cover for the end of the year special.
Oh, yeah, this is one of the big movies. Hey, maybe Travis should win a prize or something.
He already has.
Awesome. What are we going to send him?
His prize is I promise not to visit his home.
Steven Spielberg presents Gremlins. They're clever. They're mischievous. They'll get into the kitchen, the basement, the garage. They'll get into anything. And once they get in,
that's a real gremlin, my kid!
You're in for it. Gremlins. They'll be expecting you. Directed by Joe Dante. Rated PG.
Held over Budco Regency Twin, Old City Cinema, and surrounding First Run Theater.
Hey, Tom Atkins. Thrill me. You better listen to Saturday Fright Podcast.
E.G. Marshall passed away at the age of 84 back in 1998, but had amassed 153 acting credits. Notable roles in TV and film include 1954's The Caine Mutiny, The Bamboo Prison, 12 episodes of the 1953 to 1955 TV series You Are There, before appearing in the amazing 1957 film adaptation of 12 Angry Men, one of my favorite movies of all time. Marshall appeared alongside Orson Welles, Dean Stockwell, Martin Milner, and Diane Varzi in 1959's Compulsion, He appeared in 132 episodes of the popular 1961 to 1965 TV series, The Defenders, before appearing in 1970's Tora, Tora, Tora. He was the President of the United States in 1980's Superman II, and in 1989 appeared in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. The part of George Reynolds, the executive talking with Marshall's character at the beginning of the film, I couldn't find any info on. So if you know who the actor was, please do give us a shout with the answer. The part of Mrs. Kastenmeier, though, was played by, well, I've seen two different sources with two different answers. One claims that it was All That Jazz's and Cocoon's Gwen Verdon, while the Internet Movie Database says it is actually Anne Muffley, who appeared in 1972's Season of the Witch and 1983's Flashdance. Listening to both, I think I'm going to have to side with those that say it's Gwen Verdon.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the tap? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz, start the car, I know a whoopee spot where the gin is cold but the piano's hot. It's just a noisy hall where there's a nightly brawl. And all that.
Friends, I think that about wraps up the episode. On behalf of the projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you will hop on over to the Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Twisted Toys is the name of our ending theme and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, the Projectionist. Where can people find you if they wish to contact you?
Sage, this box that Stevie brought in is from Haddonfield.
Okay. Projectionist, where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
No, I must get back down to the lower levels immediately before it's too late.
Projectionist?
I don't care for current technological standards, but I'm sometimes on the Facebooks. Projectionist, Haunted Drive-In.
We have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you, and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Our podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and we would certainly appreciate it if you could click subscribe. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows, or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to the Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in the Retroist Vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have retro needs, and you know, we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, let's find out what the Projectionist is doing. The vault is sealed. This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye, and we hope to see you next time.